Steve Corbett is going to win this winning fourth running of the Kentucky Derby.
They come on down to the finish. Affirm Denali Dar. Here's the finish. Affirm.
Affirm Denali Dar. Heads apart. Affirm's got a nose in front as they come onto the wire.
This is In the Room with Sean Clancy.
I'm Sean Clancy, and I'm in the room with jockey Steve Coffin. Three Eclipse Awards in one season, the Triple Crown, three-time British champion jockey, Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year, the Hall of Fame. It is my pleasure and honor to be in the room with the kid, Steve Coffin. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks, Sean. Good to be with you.
It's Belmont Stakes Day and Epsom Derby Day. Let's start there. Take us back to Affirmed and the Triple Crown on the line in 1978. What was the pressure like for you, an 18-year-old kid, with that kind of moment in your hands?
Yeah, that's probably the most pressure I've ever felt, you know, going into a race, you know, because I really kind of felt the Derby didn't, you know, disturb me too much, and the Preakness either. But then obviously, you know, when you got the chance to win the Triple Crown and kind of be a part of, you know, you're already a part of history, but, you know, to be a significant part of, you know, I think at that point only 10 had done it before. So, you know, it was an opportunity, and I didn't want to mess it up. So, yeah, I was feeling a little, you know, a little bit of pressure, but, you know, I knew I could count on the horse. And so, you know, it was exciting at the same time.
Yeah, how did you deal with that pressure? Is there people you talk to, or you have a way of dealing with it, or you're that young and don't really process it? I mean, what was that like?
Nah, you know, I think I process it. You know, just, you know, I didn't really, you know, I obviously wasn't going to go talk to any of my competitors to, you know, let them know I was feeling a little bit anxious about it. But, you know, obviously, you know, I talked to, you know, my parents, you know, I didn't talk to them and say, oh, I'm feeling, you know, I'm feeling nervous or whatever. But, you know, just talking to them made me, you know, settled me down some. And just, you know, talking to people that, you know, are going to love you whether, you know, you win or lose or whatever happens. So, you know, just kind of knowing what's real and what's, you know, obviously, you know, the most important things.
Sure. And what were your thoughts going into the Belmont? I mean, it's a longer race. Was that better or worse for Affirmed?
Obviously, it's an unknown for any horse. But, you know, obviously, you know, I felt like it was probably not better. I didn't know it would be worse either, but it was a big question mark. And, you know, he'd had, obviously, you know, they'd gone through a couple of tough races. You know, obviously, Aladar was kind of the bigger, more, you know, stronger looking horse. So of course those guys, you know, their team was saying, oh yeah, this time we're just going to run him into the ground. And I knew that's probably what they were going to try to do, but I knew Affirmed had a lot of heart and that, you know, he was just an extremely talented horse as well. So, you know, there was, as you say, there was never that much between them in any of the races that they ran. And it was a little bit just kind of getting the right tactics, and you know, I knew Affirm would always try to gut it out, you know, if he was good enough. So I was optimistic without being over confident, because I never was overconfident whenever I rode against Aladar, because he was a hell of a horse.
Right, for sure. Yeah, and take us through the race. Did it go as planned? I mean, were there moments where you thought, oh boy, I'm in trouble here, or what was that like?
Well, it did kind of go to, you know, the big thing was to try to slow the pace down. You know, obviously, we wanted it to be more like a mile and a quarter race than a mile and a half race, you know, so we got away with the first half of a mile and 50, which, you know, was good. And but then, yeah, that was the end of the, you know, Aladar said, you know, enough of that. But, you know, the thing was, when Aladar came to me, I just thought, you know, I know he doesn't want to go on. He doesn't want to go to the lead a mile out. I'm just going to sit here. You know, if he goes on, I'll just follow him and, you know, ride it from there. But, you know, in my heart, I knew he didn't want to go on. So, you know, once George got up to me, we just kind of sat and looked at each other for a while. And, you know, but then at some point, probably about, you know, five out, you know, obviously George, you know, the pace picked up. And, you know, the race really began. And, Yeah, obviously from that point on, it was, you know, very contentious. And at the head of the stretch, I was a little concerned because, you know, I could feel affirmed underneath me, just feeling a little bit, you know, tired. You know, I just kind of felt like he was, you know, not really, I wasn't feeling confident about it at that point, I'll put it that way. But, you know, obviously I just, you know, kept riding him, and then I hit him left-handed, and, you know, he responded, and, you know, once he got his head back in front, you know, it kind of felt like he was going to keep it in front no matter if we went another mile.
What a feeling, huh?
Yeah, tremendous feeling. It's a lot of emotions. You know, I think one of the emotions was exhilaration and also, like, an exhale of, you know, thank God that's over. And also, you know, just pride in, you know, the horse and in myself, you know. Basically, I realized that, you know, I couldn't make one mistake, you know, during the whole race and wow. still win it, you know, and that's really what happened, you know. And so, you know, it's kind of gratifying, more gratifying to win it that way, although it's very, you know, you know, get your nerves going. But, but it was a great race. It was, you know, in my mind, it was the greatest race I was ever involved in, and I rode in a lot of tight finishes and won a lot of big races in tight finishes, but that was just, you know, the epitome of what racing is all about.
And then 7 years later, you know, you've moved your tack to England and you ride Slip Anchor in the Epsom Derby, your seventh
yeah.
try in the race, the favorite for well, he wasn't Sir Henry Cecil then, but later became Sir Henry
right.
Cecil. But
mm-hmm.
Similar feeling, pressure, I mean, similar as affirmed, or what?
I mean, you know, like, obviously, it's more, you know, once you get to that stage of your life and everything, it's more that your desire to do something, you know, than the pressure of I'm worried about not doing it, you know. It's just that, like, I really just want to achieve this goal, you know. And obviously, you know, I had a lot of confidence in the horse. I called my dad and, you know, said I think I can win the Derby this year, the Derby. you know, come over. And so he was there, so that was cool.
Wow.
And, you know, Lord Howard DeWalden, who owned the horse, who also, you know, was one of the wealthiest guys in England and owned about half of London, he'd never won the Derby before. So, you know, it was like, you know, a dream of his, you know, one of the things on his bucket list. And so it was nice to do it for him. It was Henry's first Derby win. And, yeah, so there was a lot of firsts and a lot of, you know, things that were, you know, exciting for everybody that was involved. And it was nice to be correct about, you know, the horse, you know, knowing that he just had really improved, you know, in the last couple months leading up to the Derby. And, so, you know, I was feeling good about it, but obviously in any race, you know, things can go wrong, but it pretty much went exactly like I hoped it would. And he, you know, dictated the race and, just won, you know, one like a good horse should.
Yeah, the announcer turning for home. I mean, you rounded Tattenham Corner, and the announcer says, surely Steve has stolen it. What did you think when you look back and you're, what, 10 clear in a race?
I think I was more like 15 clear.
Yeah,
and, but you know,
yeah,
I mean, I you know, I hadn't really looked behind. You know, I was just pacing my horse. So, yeah, I mean, I thought I can't, yeah, as long as I don't fall over, you know, he's going to win. Because he was still trailing good at that point, you know. At the head of the lane in England, it was still 4 furlongs to go, you know. So, but yeah, I was pretty comfortable because I knew the one thing he really did, you know, was stay a mile and a half very well. So, you know, I thought there's no way they can catch me. So, I was just, you know, like you said, trying to keep him balanced and together because it's basically all the way down the straight, you're running on the side of a hill, pretty much.
Sure. And when you say pacing my horse, I guess that's what it's about in that race on a front runner, especially.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, you know, knowing that your horse is doing it well within himself, and, you know, obviously I'd ridden the horse, you know, 3 or 4 times before that. So I knew the horse. I'd been actually, I rode him out the last 3 weeks of it before the Derby. I got on him every morning. I didn't want anybody else to screw it up, you know. I didn't want anybody to, you know, anything to happen. And he was feeling so good. And one day he reared up and stood on his hind legs, you know, just straight up with me. And I thought, you know, so, you know, that's how, you know, good he was feeling in himself and getting a lot of confidence and just feeling like a man. So it was an exciting thing to be involved in. That was my first. And then a couple of years later, I got another one on Reference Point. It was a horse that totally hated the course, but, you know, was good enough to overcome it.
Yeah, he was in front, but nothing like the tour de force of Slip Anchor.
Right. I mean, I think it was just it was not so much that he couldn't. It was the undulations kind of. I was having to hold him together all the way down the stretch. You know, it was like a big, you know, baby Dewey. You know, that's you know, just felt awkward. You know, on that track where other. A nice galloping track with, you know, where you're meeting the ground. He was a powerful horse, but on that track he felt like a car with, you know, 2.5 wheels. You know?
Wow.
So yeah, it was challenging in that respect, but you know, he was obviously good enough to, you know, get it done.
Yeah, he did that on talent, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. When you look back at what you accomplished, I mean, the history of your riding career, what's that like? I mean, is it disbelief or awe or like another person? I mean, with years now in between, I mean, do you look back at it and think, how did that happen or who was that person?
I do. You know, it's like I have all those feelings. Some days I look back and think, you know, how did that happen? How did I do that? You know, why didn't I do more? Should I, you know, a lot of things, but. But, you know, obviously I'm very grateful for, you know, my career. I, you know, with age and stuff, you know, you start to realize all the wonderful people that you were involved with and you met and you're still, you know, you still know, you still, you know, follow. I mean, unfortunately, a few of them are falling by the wayside, you know, and it's sad to see them go. But, you know, I've been blessed, though. You know, I rode for some of the greatest trainers, and I think I also rode in a, you know, in a generation of, you know, terrific jockeys, you know, here in America and in Europe, you know, so it was a lot of fun. It was obviously, you know, hard work. You know, the hardest thing for me was dealing with my weight. You know, other than that, I would be riding today. You know?
Sure.
Because I enjoyed it and I loved the challenge and I loved, you know, the connection with the horses.
Yeah, no doubt. When you retired in 1992, how did you know it was time?
It was just
an easy decision, or?
Well, it was in the sense of I was just, you know, killing myself trying to keep my weight down. You know, I'd get halfway through the season and think, you know, I don't think I can make it the rest of the way, you know.
Wow.
Somehow I would manage, but, you know, it was just mentally and physically tough. And it also, on the other hand, is, you know that you're never going to be as good at anything else the rest of your life as you were at what you're quitting. So that makes it tough, you know.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
But at the same time, you know, I think it was the right decision, and I've never regretted it other than, you know, like you said, just the part of you that, you know, feels more comfortable in the, you know, on the back of a horse than anywhere else, really.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I have similar feelings when I stopped. But when you look back at your success, how much of it do you chalk up to luck, and how much of it hard work and talent?
99% hard work and 1% luck.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. No, I don't, you know, I mean, you make your own luck, you know, I mean, obviously you got to be, you know, lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time when somebody needs a good jockey. And, you know, like I was with Affirmed, right? I mean,
right.
Basically, you know, Cordero and Valette and Pinkai both had, you know, were asked to ride that horse in the Sanford Stakes before me, because they'd ridden him and won on him. But, you know,
right. They
either didn't think he was good enough. Well, both of them obviously didn't think he was that good, or they would have made the effort to come, you know.
Right.
And Cordero picked another horse. So, you know, it's good luck, and it's, you know, good luck that on their bad, you know, judgment and whatever, you know, what you want to call it. On that day, I got lucky. But, you know, if I hadn't got lucky with him, you know, I would have probably got lucky with something else. I was also... My bad luck was I was also asked to ride Spectacular Bit, and my agent chose to go somewhere else and ride something else.
Wow.
So, you know, you get good luck and you get bad luck.
And then I got one more. I got to tell you, I have this album here that I've had for a long time. It's called And Steve Coffin Sings Too. I mean, what in the world? You got to.
And my friend said, yeah, not really. Not really. But that's, hey, you know, all I can say is I look back on it with fondness because it was fun doing it. And, you know, I knew I couldn't sing anyway. The joke, actually the funniest thing that ever happened to me with that was just gotten to England, and my Jimmy Lindley, the guy that was kind of helping me learn the tracks and stuff, organized me for me to go ride in Austria on a weekend.
Wow.
And I somehow Jimmy had got the daggone record and never told me about it. So I was in the jock's room, and then that track, you have to walk down the track to get to the paddock. And I'm walking down the track, and they got, you know, loudspeakers, like, you know, and all of a sudden this music starts coming out over the loudspeaker, and I'm kind of humming, that sounds kind of familiar, and you know, it's a nice tune. And then all of a sudden my voice comes out over the loudspeaker. I almost crawled in the hole. It was like, oh, shoot. But anyway, I've got a lot of laughs out of it. It's been fun.
No question. I remember my brother and I getting that as a kid. We just, you know, we were in awe of it. We were in awe of your career.
Sounded good back then, right?
Yeah, for sure. We were like, man, we were just like that. And he can sing. I can't believe it.
Oh, my gosh. He can do everything.
That's brilliant. That's Steve Coffin, the kid. All the best, Steve. Thanks for being on the show. It's a real pleasure to talk about old memories like that.
Absolutely. Thanks, Sean. Good talking to you, buddy.